Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu. Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right.
That's All Right was Elvis Presley's first single, released 60 years ago this year. And that's just one of the 100 things our guest author and music historian says every Elvis fan should know. And on this day before the anniversary of Elvis Presley's death, she will share many more of them. And we will wonder what you love about Elvis Presley or what you want to know about the King. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, August 15th. Do you have a favorite Elvis song, movie, or memory that you would like to share? Do you have a reason why you think Elvis was loved by so many? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Jillian Garr, a music historian and journalist. She has written three books about Elvis Presley. Her latest is 100 Things Elvis Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us. Well, let's talk a little bit about That's All Right, released on July 19th, 1954. What made that a hit?
Well, it was very different, for one thing. It's interesting to think about now, but, you know, when it came out, a lot of people didn't know if Elvis was white or black because of the way his voice sounded. Now, to us, that might sound a little odd because it seems pretty obvious, but the way they mixed together R&B and country just sort of threw everybody for a loop.
Yeah, it was a different sound. So give us a little bit of Elvis 101. What's the first thing we should know about Elvis Presley?
Well, let's see. I started out just by sort of laying some of the groundwork and I guess giving a little background, kind of taking you up to the point where he recorded That's All Right, about being born in Tupelo in the 30s, 1935, and moving up to Memphis with his parents when he was a young teenager, which I think is fairly crucial because it was a real musical melting pot for the South. I mean, that's one interesting thing about Elvis is that he's called the King of Rock and Roll, but he was actually influenced by so many different types of music. There was the country music, and he loved blue. He loved gospel music, the hymns, and he loved R&B. But he also, you know, loved things like show tunes or even opera.
Yeah. Who dubbed him the King of Rock and Roll?
Well, it was the media, unsurprisingly, in writing about him. So yeah, it wasn't a label he slapped on himself. It was in 56 when he had finally signed to RCA and was becoming a national success. He was referred to that way in a newspaper article, and it stuck. I hadn't known that myself until I started working on this, and then one of my research assistants, or volunteers, I guess I should say, tracked down a couple articles where that phrase was used.
Well, talk a little bit about you and why you are such an Elvis Presley fan.
Well, I grew up a Beatles fan, and for years I thought they invented rock and roll because I didn't know there was anything before the Beatles. But then when I got a bit older and I started reading about the Beatles myself, in the very first book I read, the authorized biography, simply called The Beatles by Hunter Davies, they talk about their influences when they were growing up, and one of them was Elvis.
That's right.
And I knew who Elvis was because, obviously, he was on the radio and the movies mostly. This was the 60s, so you knew him from the movies. But I couldn't see what he had to do with rock and roll because the movies at the time were not very rockin' and rollin'. But when I read The Beatles liked him, I thought, oh, well, he must have something. And then one day I actually heard some of his 50s music instead of the tamer 60s things, mid-60s. The first song that really interested me was Hound Dog. And that was how I finally found out who he was and began being more interested.
Let's take a listen to Hound Dog.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time.
Sing it, Elvis. So why did that song impress you so much?
Well, listen to the way it starts. I mean, it's just such an exciting beginning. You know, it just kind of starts. You have the drum roll, and then he comes in. So, And it never stops. It's not one of those songs that builds and goes back down. Maybe has a quiet chorus and a louder, or a quiet verse and a louder chorus. It's just straight out all the way through. It's just, yeah, it's a really exciting number.
And that was his biggest hit.
Yes, double-sided hit with Don't Be Cruel on the Other Side. I guess he called it double A-sided hit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right, so that was going to be one of my trivia questions to listeners later, but you, that's all right, I'm just teasing. So that's why it was such a big hit, because there are two hits on 145 or whatever.
I guess you know, he's kind of lucky it didn't cancel himself. They didn't cancel each other out.
Isn't that interesting? So he did have such a long, successful, prolific career. How did you go about narrowing down your book to just 100 things Elvis fans should know and do before they die?
Well, 100's pretty big, actually, when you think about it. You know, it's not like top 10. That would be a little more challenging. But I would just think to myself, well, is this something essential that people need to know? I mean, you could easily, you know, do another 100 things list with a lot of different entries. Wouldn't be 100 completely different entries, I don't think, because there's some I think would have to be there. Like the comeback special from 1968, that would have to be on there, people learning a bit about that or knowing about that. But, yeah, it can't just be, say, a song that I liked in particular. There had to be something more about it, you know. Is this essential? Why? And that's the criteria I used to see if it made the cut or not.
We are talking with Jillian Garve. She's a music historian, journalist. She is the author of 100 Things Elvis Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And we will share more of them as we go along. We will welcome your suggestions. Do you have a favorite song or movie or experience, memory regarding Elvis Presley? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe someone's listening who saw Elvis perform live in Madison in 1977. It was just a couple of months before he passed away that there was an Elvis Presley concert in Madison, Wisconsin. We'll talk with our guest about all things Elvis Presley in just a moment and welcome your questions and your thoughts. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Walking through a party in the county jail.
Jailhouse Rock was Elvis Presley's best dance number in any of his movies, according to our guest this hour, the author of 100 Things Elvis Fans Should Know Before They Die. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What do you know, or what would you like to know about Elvis Presley? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Jillian Garr, the author of 100 Things Elvis Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. So, Jillian, Jailhouse Rock was his best dance number?
Well, I think that's just a hands-down winner. That's a pretty easy one to do. It was probably the most elaborate dance number he did in any of his films. But what was interesting about that is the choreographer was working with Elvis, and he couldn't really follow instructions and was not doing that well. But the choreographer had to think about that, and he put on one of Elvis's records and said to Elvis, well, move how you would move to your record. So Elvis did, and the choreographer said, okay, I can work with that. And then he went away and sort of patterned moves after Elvis's own moves so that he would know what to do better. And then what I really found was fascinating was as he was learning the routine, a friend took him over to Russ Tamblyn's house, the fellow actor who's later in West Side Story, played Riff in West Side Story. And Russ gave Elvis some dance tips. And his girlfriend said, this is Russ's girlfriend, said how she was so surprised she came over to see him. She walked in and there was her boyfriend dancing with Elvis.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's funny that he'd need some dancing tips, or maybe not, but he was known for, he had that nickname for a while, Elvis the Pelvis, because of his moves when he was performing.
Yeah, Russ gave him some ideas about how to knock the knee, how to throw the hip out. Remember, it's not just on the stage where it's there and gone. This would be done for all time being filmed. And, of course, the moves are different because the camera's closer, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that he was learning those moves for Jailhouse Rock well after the Ed Sullivan Show would not show him below the waist. Right?
I mean, yes, they were cautious about that.
Right. Just mentioning of Jailhouse Rock and the movies that Elvis did in the 60s, that's how I remember him at first too. I mean, what happened there? Why did he even go from being this super concert rock and roll star who had all these hit records to go? How did he start doing these movies?
Well, of course, it was sort of an obvious thing for entertainers to do. Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, they'd all done the singer and then moved on to movies as well. So it was Elvis's manager, Colonel Parker, that got him into films. And he was interested in that at first because he was a big movie fan. But I don't think he quite foresaw where it was going to go.
Yeah. What are some of the movies that you think were his best?
Well, he always thought King Creole was his best, and that's a good one, too. And Loving You, which is another one from the 50s and sort of a vaguely based on his own life story. Those would be the three best, I think. And then in the 60s, it's very much a mixed bag. You kind of pick and choose throughout. I like Blue Hawaii a lot. It's the first of the three he did in Hawaii, and I think it's the best. And I also like Hawaii quite a bit, so it's nice seeing the film for that. And then after that, I don't know, people have different views of, I guess you'd say Viva Las Vegas would be a good one. I'm not as keen on the story, but Anne Margaret, his co-star, was one of his best co-stars, and they get to dance together. So anytime they're together, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. They did more than dance together, though, didn't they?
Well, yes, they did have a relationship.
Yeah.
Much to Priscilla's annoyance.
I mean, was that that was his only high-profile affair?
Well, I'm not sure about high-profile. I guess there were rumors in the press that they were having an affair. So yeah, I guess you could say that was high-profile. But you wouldn't say that he was a one-woman man. He always seemed to be seeing a few women. At the same time.
Yeah. But he tell us a little bit about Priscilla. I mean, she, I guess she was, you know, how did he meet her?
Well, this happened when he was in the army, and they'd sent him over to Germany. And he, of course, was depressed at having to put his career on hold for a couple of years. I mean, they made out like, oh, yeah, he was proud to go and serve his country and all this. And actually, he was quite unhappy about having to go. But the colonel thought it would be good for his image. And, I mean, here's someone who'd never really lived away from his family at all. I mean, yes, he'd been on the road the last couple of years, but he always went back home. I think it's interesting that when he came into money, you know, he bought a home for him and his family to live in, not he bought a home for his parents, then he lived elsewhere, as you might do as an adult. You know, he stayed with his family. So he was over in Germany and felt lonely and isolated, and of course brought his family over with him because they were his legal dependents, so he could have his father and some friends over. And it was so when he'd come back from his day's work in the evening, because he could live off base, of course, he would have gatherings at his home. People would just hang out, and not a party per se, but, you know, he just liked having people come over and hang out. And so a mutual acquaintance brought Priscilla over. She was also, her father was in the Air Force, so there was the military connection. Someone had met her at one of the military facilities on base. Where the relatives of the military personnel could hang out, you know, like a clubhouse type of place, and brought her over to meet Elvis, because what 14-year-old wouldn't jump at the chance to meet Elvis?
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, he just picked up on her right away. I mean, he was 10 years older than her, and you have to kind of wonder what the attraction was. I think maybe the fact that she was so young, and he felt that he could perhaps shape her personality and create her into the ideal woman for him, which didn't work out that way. But at the time they met, I think he could. In her book, she writes very movingly about how they went upstairs to his bedroom, and she was a little nervous about that, but he said, no, you know, don't worry, I'm not going to touch you in any way that you don't want. And she said in those hours up there they'd spend together, he would just talk to her about how vulnerable he felt. And I suppose he didn't feel he could do that with friends that were his age, especially his male friends. You know, he felt he had to be the tough guy image, or, you know, a stronger person, not necessarily tough guy, but couldn't admit to feeling frightened and vulnerable at times. And he could do that with her.
And why did his marriage to Priscilla end? Did Anne Margaret have anything to do with that?
No, because the marriage ended much later than that. Let's see, when were they making that movie? I think Viva Las Vegas made in 63, and Priscilla didn't leave until the end of 71, I think. Well, as I like to put it, I think the marriage ended because Priscilla grew up, basically.
Mm-hmm.
She came over to stay with Elvis about 2 years after they met. I think so it should be, what, 16? And they actually lived together, which they kept very quiet, which is amazing to think about. You know, here's the all-American boy pretty much living with someone in the mid-60s was not all that common, especially for a big star like him. But for some reason, people looked the other way. And I think she just got tired of the cloistered world that he lived in, where he'd like to stay up all night and sleep during the day, which in itself keeps you somewhat isolated. And I think the big change was when he started touring again. At first, he was doing the Vegas seasons and just appearing in Las Vegas, but then he began going on the road. And Priscilla writes how when he first went to Vegas, she was able to come all the time, but then eventually Elvis laid down this law that wives and girlfriends could only be there at the opening and the closing of the shows. And they were all running around the rest of the time, and their wives and girlfriends weren't there. And then on the road, of course, there weren't wives or girlfriends. And she knew he was running around. And I think she just wanted to, I think in her book she says, again, you know, kind of movingly about things she wanted to do. She wanted to be able to walk out in the sunlight with her husband holding hands down by the lake or something. And he just wasn't that kind of person. He had this bubble he lived in and did not step outside of it.
Let's take a call before our news break. Dan in Drummond. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Well, my two favorite songs by him were Wooden Heart and Are You Lonesome Tonight?
Yeah. And
that's a good one.
And why do you and you also wanted to talk about why you thought people liked Elvis so much?
I think what he did, he bridged the generation gap at that period of time from Frank Sinatra and like it's today, Bing Crosby, into the early rock scene and that, like Bill Haley and the Comets in the 50s and that. And I think that's what people liked was the fact that he was willing to do a lot of the old songs and then do some of the kids' songs.
Did he do a little of both, Jillian?
Yeah, well, gosh, very, very versatile. I mentioned all the musical influences, and he put that in his music, too. He actually did, you know, all those different kinds of things. Yeah, Wooden Heart, that was the one he sang at a puppet show in the movie, G.I. Blues.
That was my mom's favorite song. That's interesting.
Oh. Yeah.
But, you know, with just a minute to go, I thought that the parents of that generation when Elvis came out were thinking that this was, this was the end of civilization as we knew it.
Well, the parents, yes, but that changed over time. That was certainly one reason why the colonel wanted to get him in the army, because that began changing those parents' views.
Oh, really? He thought that was a PR move.
Yeah, yeah, in a lot of ways. He didn't necessarily... I wondered if he really had to go into the service, because after he wasn't drafted... The different branches of the service approached him and were going to, you know, set up deals to where maybe he could tour the country, going to induction stations, that kind of thing. And didn't, kind of the sort of thing that entertainers did during World War II. Oh,
yeah. Well, we'll talk more about the colonel. We haven't really talked a lot about him yet. And other things that we should know or do if we are Elvis Presley fans, and we'll welcome your favorite Elvis songs or movies or memories. This is the Ideas Network.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
Don't Be Cruel was on the B-side of Hound Dog, which was Elvis Presley's most successful hit. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are commemorating Elvis Presley on this anniversary of his death. Elvis died 37 years ago tomorrow. And we are talking with a guest music historian and Elvis fan, and we are welcoming your thoughts and questions about Elvis Presley. Do you have a favorite Elvis song or movie? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Jillian Garr. She is the author of 100 Things Every Elvis Fan Should Know and Do Before They Die. And Jillian, I said before news time that we talk a little bit more about the colonel. Who's the colonel?
Well, the colonel was Elvis's manager. He was his only manager. And he ran his career with an iron fist, I guess you'd say. I don't think he was the best manager for Elvis. He started out well. I think he was a better promoter than he was a manager. And he helped bring him from being a regional talent to a national talent to an international talent, really. And in the 50s, that worked fine. But then I think from the Army days on, the colonel had a lot of missteps. When Elvis came out of the Army, he put him in movies through most of the decade. And Elvis only did a few live shows at the beginning of the 60s. And then spent most of the decade making movies that became worse and worse in quality. He was looking at the bottom line all the time and thought this would just be an easy way to get movies, and you could add music with the soundtracks, and it was all one big package and you didn't have to do anything else, which perhaps would have been fine if the movies had been better and Elvis enjoyed making them, but he didn't. This is why if you look in the films, he starts putting on weight about the mid-60s or so, because he didn't care for his movies at all, and he got to hate doing the recording sessions when he had to do them for the soundtracks. The other musicians, some of them told me, just said the derisive way he'd refer to the material that he had to do, things like Old MacDonald, a sort of, excuse me, rewritten version of Old MacDonald that he sang while riding in a truck full of livestock. Those kind of things he didn't enjoy doing. But then even when you get to the 70s and Elvis is back on the road again, it just becomes another rut for him because of the way the Colonel directed things. Elvis always liked having a big challenge to rise to, like the 68 comeback special, the first debut in Vegas in 69, and then the Aloha from Hawaii show. But the Colonel didn't keep giving him challenges, and one big thing he missed out on was that he never let Elvis tour overseas. The speculation is that the Colonel didn't allow this because he was actually an illegal immigrant, and he was afraid of not being able to come back into the country with Elvis if he went on tour with him.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, his history is pretty fascinating as well. He was Dutch, and he came into the country in the 20s, and to legitimize himself, he had joined the army right away. And while he was in the army, he took on the Americanized name of Tom Parker. And then when he came out, he began working in showbiz a bit. He was a promoter before he went on to manage acts like Hank Snow. You know, when he was in the army, he was stationed in Hawaii. And I've often wondered if that was the reason why he brought Elvis back there so much. Because when he was there, it was, you know, 1930. It was well before Hawaii was a state. And even when Elvis first went there in 57, it was not yet a state. Statehood didn't come for two more years. But I was thinking that Hawaii in 1930 must have just been so idyllic, unlike the touristy areas are now.
Was the Colonel the reason why he seems to be the one blamed for getting Elvis hooked on drugs?
No. I mean, I guess maybe you could say indirectly, because he put him in these movies that Elvis didn't like, and he was unhappy, and he was bored, and as a result, he did drugs. So you could say, mm-hmm. you know, indirectly. But directly, no, I wouldn't say that.
Just because we've got a lot to talk about, but how exactly did Elvis die?
Well, of course, there was a controversy about that for many years, because the official story was a heart attack. But he was 42, and well, it's not unknown for a man to have a heart attack. Then it's more unusual. And when it came out that he had been taking all these drugs, it was very shocking to a lot of people. People thought a bit differently about addiction then, and is all right. They saw it as a moral failing and rather than a disease. But other people, hearing the number of drugs he had in his system, because he did indeed have a lot, thought, well, you know, it was drug related. There was one book I read, though, down at the end of Lonely Street, and the authors talked to someone who looked at the when the case was reinvestigated or reopened. The autopsy results were reexamined years later, and those results were not made public. But the authors were able to speak to the doctor who'd made the call, and the way he explained things, it did convince me that it was a heart attack, because he talked about things like condition of the body, that Elvis's lungs are very dry, and that wouldn't have happened if it was an overdose. I think you could, I would say he did die of a heart attack, but you certainly wouldn't be wrong by saying that it was drug-related, because he was in ill health, and the drug use contributed to that.
Yes.
The problem with the drug use is that he wasn't really doing this for recreation. It wasn't recreational drug use per se.
He was doing it to get up and go to sleep and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because of his work schedule.
I guess initially, even the guys would say, that's what they called his buddies, the Memphis Mafia, also just the guys. They have said that certainly in the early 60s, a lot of them would take speed or amphetamines to stay up and run around all night because it was fun. And not even necessarily for the high, just to give themselves energy. But yeah, Elvis had gotten this sort of vicious cycle to where you take all that speed, and then when you need to sleep, you take some downers. And then, of course, your body gets used to it. You need more and more. So it's just this vicious cycle.
Yeah.
And
let me share a comment from a listener on Facebook who writes, I remember the day Elvis died like it was yesterday. I was stationed in Germany, and the American Forces Radio Service shut down all scheduled programming and paid tribute to Elvis, the king. It was beautiful. Elvis was a class act all the way around. He didn't use shock value in place of talent to entertain. He had raw, natural talent as a singer and an entertainer. He had charisma like none other. Elvis will live forever through his music, unlike these flash-in-the-pan entertainers today. A response to that.
my response to that?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, I do always wonder when people say about anyone, oh, they'll last more than what's going on now. I think, well, when this entertainer came out, that's what people were saying about them. And history is a very funny thing. You wonder what's going to be sorted out in years. I think his music deserves to be remembered and known 500 years from now. But who knows what's going to happen, how it will shake down. I mean, you remember the movie Amadeus. Mozart wasn't the top of the pops then, but now he's revered.
Yeah. Why is there still a... It is true, though, that I think that's one of those moments in history that... So many of us know where we were when it was announced that Elvis had died.
Well, I think it's because he was the first big rock star. He wasn't the first rocker. He didn't invent rock and roll, but he was the first rocker that took it to the mainstream and was the first one that had a huge, sustained success with it. So I think that's why it sticks in. Yeah. He was an innovator, and so people remember those.
So why do you think there's still a debate over whether Elvis is dead or not?
I don't know. I'm really not much of one for a conspiracy theories. But I think people believe in them for a number of different reasons. I suppose a real basic one would be at the time some people just thought, well, he's too young. He can't be dead. He's only 42. So I think part of it's perhaps a kind of wish fulfillment type of thing. I also think that people like to believe things like this because it imposes some kind of order on a chaotic situation. And how much better to think that instead of life being this random, full of random occurrences, that in fact there's something planned behind it. So maybe that makes people feel better too.
We are talking with Jillian Garr, a music historian, a journalist. She's written 3 books about Elvis Presley. Her latest is 100 Things Elvis Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And we welcome your questions for her, and we welcome any favorite memories or songs or movies. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
And his hunger burns. So he starts to roam the streets at night, and he learns how to steal, and he learns how to fight in the ghetto.
We are talking about Elvis Presley on this day before the anniversary of his death. We are talking with the author of 100 Things Elvis Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. We're talking about many of the things that we should know. We will talk about some of the places we should go and visit before the end of the hour with our guest, Jillian Garr. So, Jillian, talk a little bit about... In the ghetto, this was one of his few, social, political songs.
Yes, and in fact, he had some hesitancy about recording it. He'd gone back to record in Memphis in 1969 for the first time since his Sun era. And he was working with a producer named Chips Moman at the American Sound Studios. They just put a plaque outside the where the studios used to be located in Memphis. Because it wasn't only Elvis that recorded there. A lot of artists recorded there in the 60s. And I think during this one period there in the 60s, there were 120 chart-placing records that were recorded at that studio by, you know, artists like, well, Dusty Springfield was there, Marilee Rush, Angel of the Morning, that song, Neil Diamond, and Elvis. And Mac Davis had written that song, and it was on a tape with a demo tape of his stuff. And there was some people advised Elvis not to record it, because, yeah, it was too political, and was it too much of a statement? It's a pretty mild statement, really, but even at the time, I think you could say it was pretty mild. You know, the basic thing is treat people well, and they'll turn out all right, and if you treat them badly, then they won't turn out so well, which, you know, pretty mild to my way of thinking.
Yeah. Elvis may have preferred to be an entertainer and refrain from politics, Didn't he go to the White House and meet with Richard Nixon and want to talk about the war on drugs or something along those lines?
That was sort of his reason for going there. But the real reason he went was because he wanted to get a badge from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, sort of ironic considering his own drug use
right.
and abuse, one might say. But he by that time had begun collecting police badges from places around the U.S., and he'd met someone that had a BENDD badge, and he wanted one for himself. So this still amazes me that it happened this way. You think this is something that really couldn't have happened today. Probably the security measures would prevent it.
Yeah.
But he'd been flying around the country and just goes to the White House and leaves a letter saying that he wanted to talk to the president and help out in promoting the American way across the country. And he would be at this certain hotel in D.C., and they'd get in touch with him there. And the letter went up the chain, and as it happened, it was a day when Nixon had a sort of free hour where they could do impromptu last-minute things that came up. And so Elvis got to see him that day. I mean, I can't think of anyone else. I can't think today that someone could show up at the gates of the White House, no matter who they are, and give a letter saying, you know, I want to see the president, and they get in that day. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
That is. Very, very famous photo that my husband's former co-workers took and then superimposed my husband's head on Elvis's head. So we have that. We have Bob on Facebook who says, please speak about Elvis's religious influences later in life, namely New Age and other esoteric philosophies.
Oh, yeah. Elvis definitely had an inquiring mind about all kinds of things. A lot of that goes back to in the 60s, he was getting his hair styled by his fellow named Larry Geller. I think it was for the movie Speedway. Excuse me. Anyway, as they're chatting, Elvis asked him, well, what kind of things are you into, Larry? And Larry was into studying what we would call New Age philosophy types of things. And I think, as Larry put it, well, I think our purpose in life is to find out what our purpose in life is. And Elvis was intrigued, I think, in part because he was in the middle of a film career he wasn't enjoying that much and was looking for something to engage his interest. And so he picked up on that and began reading, the autobiography of a yogi and looking into all different kinds of philosophies and religions. I know in the 70s there was a time he wore a crucifix and a Star of David. And someone asked him, rather, why are you wearing both? And he said, well, I don't want to be kept out of heaven on a technicality.
You know, we're almost out of time, and we haven't talked about a couple of things I wanted to talk about, including We have a lot of things we should know about Elvis that we've discussed, but not a whole lot about what we should do. I'm assuming we should all go to Graceland. That's the number one thing people should do. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. Definitely go to Graceland. And I think if you're interested in pop culture, I think you'd be interested in Graceland. You don't have to be an Elvis fan. Obviously, it's more interest if you are. But I always tell people if I know they're going to Memphis and maybe they're not a big Elvis fan, I say you've got to see Graceland, and to do the whole tour, because they have the mansion tour you can take, but then also across the street they have a museum with all his cars. Yes, a museum just full of his cars and golf carts and snowmobiles and things, and the planes. Police Marie and the smaller plane that his manager used. And you can actually, you know, go up and walk through the Lisa Marie, which I think is kind of fun.
Yeah. And the there's also in Memphis, while we're there, we should go to Sun Studios.
Yes, yes. It's probably, you know, it's probably the size of one of the rooms in your house, which is an exaggeration. Of course, a lot of other people recorded there, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison. The tour doesn't take very long, but it is, very, very memorable. Memphis itself, you know, it's not, the areas where Elvis went, it's a pretty small contained area. There was a great book I liked called Memphis Elvis Style by Cindy Hazen and Mike Freeman, and that lists all the Elvis sites in Memphis and how to get to them so you can do your own Elvis tour. Mm. You can see where he grew up. If you're there during Elvis Week, in fact, which is going on
right now, mm-hmm.
the place where he lived in Lauderdale Courts, you can tour that. The rest of the time, it's not a hotel. I think that might be the only room in there that's rented out. But during Elvis Week, and I think probably during Birthday Week in January, you can see where Elvis lived. Go in and see where he lived, and contrast that to Graceland.
Yeah, you know, my husband, I mentioned, is an Elvis fan. Maybe not, he's not at Elvis Week, let's put it that way. But he and I went to Graceland, and it was a lot of fun. I noticed, though, there was a controversy over the tombstone where Elvis is buried there, or his tombstone's there anyway. And the spelling of his middle name is different than how it is on his birth certificate. What's the story behind that?
Right. That's a clue how some people said, oh, well, he's not really dead because they misspelled his name on the tombstone. Well, it's true. There is a difference. It's different on the birth certificate, Aaron, with one A, as opposed to the tombstone, which is two A's. I know Elvis Presley Enterprises has just tried to downplay that and said, well, you know, Elvis was going to change it officially anyway, which I don't know that was something he was thinking about at the time.
Yeah.
But I've wondered if it was just perhaps that the doctor got it wrong, or because he was a welfare birth, really. Gladys had, the Presleys had no money for what prenatal care, as we'd call it now. And the only time she saw a doctor during her pregnancy was when he showed up to deliver the baby, or babies, actually. She had twins and one died, as people may not know. And I just assumed it was maybe sloppiness on the doctor's part.
You know, I hope that we can, we're a minute to go here, not less than a minute. Maybe we can go out with the last of Elvis's hits. I picked up from your book, it was Burning Love?
Mm, yeah, the last big hit, yes.
Yeah. And I guess, do you think that Elvis's appeal will continue to endure for generations to come?
Well, probably. I know that people that used to like Elvis will get their kids into Elvis. When you go to Elvis Week, you will see younger people there. And yeah. They keep, you know, trying to put out new releases and things to keep people interested.
Jillian, thanks very much for being with us. Jillian Garr is the author of 100 Things Every Elvis Fan Should Know and Do Before They Die. Thanks to Robin Sherry, who scheduled this program, to Cynthia Schuster, who produced and directed it, and to Justin Williams for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.